from New York. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahwa, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات درجات لأبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories: Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement flies a drone over Israel and returns it safely after 40 minutes. U.S. President Joe Biden claims Russia is preparing for an invasion of Ukraine in the coming days. And from using pepper spray to making arrests to towing trucks, Canadian riot police resort to heavy-handed tactics in dealing with freedom convoy protesters.
Yeah, the lady got fully trampled by the horse. What are you doing?
Those were the top stories. Welcome. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says it has successfully flown a reconnaissance drone over Israel. Hezbollah says the mission lasted 40 minutes and the aircraft returned untouched despite attempts by the Israeli side to down it. The Israeli military said its air defense system fired at the drone, but it went off the radar before being intercepted. Reports say Israeli warplanes later flew low over the Lebanese capital, where a loud sound was heard. Earlier, we got in touch with Mariam Saleh, our correspondent in Beirut. She gave us the context for Hezbollah's mission and what it means.
This is a very significant incident. It's not the first time that Hezbollah was able to fly a drone over, of course, what they consider is occupied Palestine, but they are monitoring the Israelis. And of course, this is specifically is very significant because the Israelis almost had no clue what was happening. One of the most important things is that the Israelis are launching right now maneuvers. They were actually taking place coinciding at the same time as the drone flew over. Hezbollah seemed to be sending a message to the Israelis that we know and they have intelligence what maneuvers are being held. The maneuvers are basically a drill to see how the Israelis can deal with a possible Hezbollah, as they call it, invasion of the Galilee. And so if Hezbollah decides to go and attack the Israelis within the territory of Palestinian, northern Palestine, that itself is considered a very big concern for the Israelis. And this is why they're conducting these drills. And therefore, Hezbollah decided to fly those drones. And it's still not accurate whether it's one or two, but they flew the drones over the maneuvers, and they were able to monitor them. They were able to get intelligence. They were probably able to take footage of what was happening, and then that returned. The drone returned safely to its destination, and this in itself is considered very significant. The Israelis have to use F-16 fighter jets in order to try to target those drones, and still they could not, and they lost track of them finally, and just guessed that probably they went back. And Hezbollah, of course, stressed that this was done, and this was the case, that Hezbollah was able to fly that drone. So what we have here is basically a tit-for-tat strategy for Hezbollah. It's no longer just waiting for the Israelis to come bringing their drones to the Lebanese airspace and Hezbollah trying to defend or deter them. It's also Hezbollah actually flying those planes over Israeli targets and military targets and military drones.
Political commentator Jamal Wakim says sending the drone to fly over Israel and getting it back safely sends a message to the Israeli regime that Hezbollah is fully ready for any military confrontation.
This incident comes 2 days after the speech of Sayyid Nasrallah in commemoration of the 14th anniversary of martyrdom of Imad Magnihi, who was the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the resistance, and in which he said that the strength of the resistance is increased, and that the resistance not only has the know-how of how to produce these drones, but they are actually producing them. So sending one reconnaissance drone in a challenge to the Israelis is a message from Sayyid Nasrallah that we are serious about what we are saying. And the fact that the Hezbollah were able to send the drone and get it back safe and sound this is evidence that they are in full control of the drones, and they can, in case there is a confrontation, a military confrontation, they can send hundreds and thousands of drones and get them back, and this would be harmful to the security of the Zionist entity.
Iran calls on the Western signatories to the 2015 deal to show real flexibility and offer initiatives. The ongoing talks aimed at reviving the accord. The Iranian foreign minister says the Western side's approach towards Tehran's initiatives determines whether the talks will yield results in the coming days or weeks. Hossein Amir Abdullahian has expressed hope that the parties involved in the negotiations will reach a good agreement in the near future. He made their remarks before attending the Munich Security Conference in Germany. This comes as Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are engaged in intensive negotiations in Vienna to restore the agreement, which has been left in a limbo following the U.S. withdrawal in 2018. Iran insists that a revival of the deal hinges on political decisions by the U.S. and the Europeans, as well as verifiable removal of sanctions. Our correspondent in Vienna, Homa Lesgi, joined us earlier with an update on the ongoing talks in Vienna between Iran and the P4+1 group of countries.
This morning, there was a meeting between the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Ali Bagherikani, and the EU coordinator, Enrica Mora. And we just also heard last night from Russian Ambassador Mikhail Oryanov that he believes the sides still need time in order to be able to resolve the outstanding issues. And Mr. Oryanov has also recently tweeted saying that as we get closer to a final agreement and the final stages of the negotiations, in his words, opponents are becoming more proactive and are trying to create an unhealthy atmosphere in the public space. as these talks are reaching the last or final stage. And this could be a reference to certain reports that have been circulating in the media about, for instance, the context of a possible agreement, the contents and what the draft would entail, etc. And those reports, of course, have been rejected or dismissed by Iranian officials and sources. And as we know, one of the advisors to the Iranian negotiating team, Professor Mohammad Marandi, has also said that those reports are not credible. And when talks conclude, and if that happens, we will see the deeply flawed nature of these reports. And he's also said that some Europeans are hampering progress by introducing demands that go beyond Iran's JCPOA commitments. So this is also what we've been hearing from other sources close to the Iranian negotiating team. They've been also suggesting that some of the sides, presumably the Europeans, are putting forward last-minute demands or making requests that go beyond the framework and the commitments that have been outlined in the 2015 agreement known as the JCPOA.
Senior Iranian official has warned Europe that its support for the terrorist Mujahideen Khalq organization will come at a price, just as it did with Daesh. Qasem Gharibabadi says it's disgraceful that European lawmakers are turning a blind eye to MKO crimes for their own political interests. Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights says Europe and the United States have committed the biggest crime against the Iranian nation through support for terrorist groups as well as illegal sanctions. Gharibabadi stressed that European countries must be accountable for their human rights violations and are in no position to preach others in this regard. About 12,000 Iranians have fallen victim to the MKO's act of terror. Over the past four decades, the terrorist group is currently based in Albania, where it enjoys freedom of activity after being delisted by the EU and the US in 2009 and 2012, respectively. The U.S. president ramps up his rhetoric against Russia amid mounting tensions in Eastern Europe. Joe Biden once again claims that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is imminent.
But the fact remains, Russian troops currently have Ukraine surrounded from Belarus along the Russian border and with Ukraine to the Black Sea in the south and all of its border. You know, look, we have reason to believe the Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week, in the coming days. We believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people. We're
calling out Russia's plan. Biden said he is convinced that his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, has already made up his mind on invasion of Ukraine. The U.S. president warned that war will close the window for diplomacy with Moscow. Biden also said Western countries will not deploy troops in Ukraine, but will continue to bolster its defensive capabilities. Earlier, the White House said Washington and its allies are working on a sanctions package in case of a Russian invasion. This is while Italy says the bans should not target energy imports from Russia. Two explosions rocked the city of Luhansk in eastern Ukraine as tensions escalate between government troops and pro-Russian forces. Russian media said one of the blasts hit a gas pipeline near Luhansk. A second explosion struck the city 40 minutes later. There are no reports of casualties. Meanwhile, France and Germany urged Russia to use its influence on pro-Russian groups for de-escalation in eastern Ukraine. This comes as pro-Russian forces and the Ukrainian military shelled one another's positions. Each side accuses the other one of violating a 2015 ceasefire. Russia has expressed concern over the renewed clashes, describing the situation as potentially very dangerous. The leader of pro-Russian forces has announced the evacuation of civilians in Donetsk and Luhansk areas. Joining us out of Moscow itself is Mr. Andrei Kortonov. He is the director of Director General with Russian International Affairs Council, I should say. Many, many thanks, sir, for joining our broadcast. How do you describe and what is your reading of the situation that we are witnessing in that part of the world today?
Well, thank you for inviting me. I guess that the situation in Donbas might be more dangerous than the situation along the Russian-Ukrainian border because the latter is more or less under control. And I still don't believe that Russia is ready for a full-scale invasion because this invasion is not likely to benefit Russia, and it will be a very costly enterprise. I don't think that Russia is in a position to occupy Ukraine or to take the capital of the country. However, what we see in Donbas is a very clear case of an inadvertent escalation, something that you cannot control. There are loose cannons on both sides, on the Ukrainian side and on the side of breakaway republics. And the worst case scenario is that the Kremlin will be forced to recognize diplomatically the leadership of the two republics. They would call Russia to grant them military assistance, and such assistance will be granted, which would mean that sooner or later we will have a direct confrontation between Russia and Ukraine in the area of Donbas. That will be the end. That would be the end of the Minsk agreements, and definitely that would have very serious implications for the European security at large.
Okay, and of course, deputy head of the Russian Duma, I heard that he has apparently said that if the U.S. and NATO are after placing their military near the Russian borders, perhaps Russia can reciprocate by taking some of its own military in some Latin American countries in order to basically, like I said, reciprocate the act. And how realistic do you think is this? And, you know, in case, because we have the history showing that, well, Russian missiles were for a while, you know, stationed in Cuba. Do you think it will have, if operational, do you think it will have a deterrent on basically, you know, the westward, the eastward expansion of the Western forces, you know, so-called these days?
Well, indeed, Russia might consider what they call asymmetrical responses to the advancement of the NATO military infrastructure closer to its borders, and it can create challenges to U.S. security, maybe in Latin America. It might create problems for the West in regions like the Middle East or Africa. There are many ways in which Russia can complicate lives of its Western neighbors. The problem with these actions is that they're not likely to enhance Russia's own security. And if Russia goes along this path, we will see an overall decline of strategic stability all over the place, and the risks of a major conflict, including a nuclear conflict, are likely to increase. So in the end of the day, both sides will have to get back to a negotiating table. The question is what price they are ready to pay before they do that. I hope that the price will not be prohibitively high.
And just a short answer, do you say, I mean, given the situation today that we are in right now, would you say that we are moving towards a war in that part of the world, or do you think we are on the de-escalation course?
I think the chances of a clash in Donbas are getting higher. The chances of a big war between Russia and Ukraine are still rather low.
Okay, many, many thanks for that answer. This is Mr. Andrei Kortonov. He is the Director General with Russian International Affairs Council out of Moscow. Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. Let's move on to another story. Now it happens to be our headline story as well. Canadian police have arrested more than 100 people in the capital, Ottawa, while trying to disperse demonstrators protesting COVID restrictions.
They have been charged with multiple various offenses, including mischief. Work is underway by the City of Ottawa to remediate and clean up the area that we have gained back today.
Some protesters have been dragged from their vehicles. Others resisting the police advance have been thrown to the ground before being arrested. The crackdown comes after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau invoked emergency powers to stop the protests. Truckers began their protests against coronavirus vaccine mandates in Ottawa almost 3 weeks ago. Demonstrations then spread to other cities. Demonstrators have also blocked several U.S.-Canada border crossings, disrupting this transportation and trade. And that's it with international news. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger, to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me, in full, in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
Limelight. Massive study shows a long-term substantial rise in risk of cardiovascular disease, including heart attack and stroke, after a SARS-CoV-2 infection, according to an article published in the Nature. This article is titled, Heart Disease Risk Soars After COVID, Even with a Mild Case. Stay tuned for more. Even a mild case of COVID-19 can increase a person's risk of cardiovascular problems for at least a year after diagnosis, a new study shows. Researchers found that rates of many conditions, such as heart failure and stroke, were substantially higher in people who had recovered from COVID-19 than in similar people who hadn't had the disease. What's more, the risk was elevated even for those who were under 65 years of age and lacked risk factors such as obesity and diabetes. It doesn't matter if you are young or old. It doesn't matter if you smoked or you didn't, says study co-author Ziad Al-Ali at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and the chief of research and development for the Veterans Affairs St. Louis Healthcare System. He added, the risk was there. Al-Ali and his colleagues based their research on an extensive health record database curated by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. The researchers compared more than 150,000 veterans who survived for at least 30 days after contracting COVID-19 with two groups of uninfected people. A group of more than 5 million people who used the VA medical system during the pandemic, and a similarly sized group that used the system in 2017, before SARS-CoV-2 was circulating. People who had recovered from COVID-19 showed stark increases in 20 cardiovascular problems over the year after infection. For example, they were 52% more likely to have had a stroke than the contemporary control group, meaning that out of every 1,000 people studied, there were around 4 more people in the COVID-19 group than in the control group who experienced stroke. The risk of heart failure increased by 72%, or around 12 more people in the COVID-19 group per 1,000 studied. Hospitalization increased the likelihood of future cardiovascular complications, but even people who avoided hospitalization were at higher risk for many conditions. I'm actually surprised by these findings that cardiovascular complications of COVID can last so long, Hussein Ardhali, a cardiologist at Northwestern University in Chicago, Illinois, wrote in an email to Nature. Because severe disease increased the risk of complications much more than mild disease, Ardhali wrote, it is important that those who are not vaccinated get their vaccine immediately. Ardhali cautions that the study's observational nature comes with some limitations. For example, people in the contemporary control group weren't tested for COVID-19, so it's possible that some of them actually had mild infections, and because the authors considered only VA patients, a group that's predominantly white and male, their results might not translate to all populations. Ardhali and Al-Ali agree that healthcare providers around the world should be prepared to address an increase in cardiovascular conditions. But with high COVID-19 case counts still straining medical resources, Al-Ali worries that health authorities will delay preparing for the pandemic's aftermath for too long. He said, "We collectively dropped the ball on COVID, and I feel we're about to drop the ball on long COVID."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Hezbollah had been vanquished. That's perhaps the most significant and upsetting question about the 2006 war.
Much has been said about the 2006 war, about its motives, the behind the scenes, and the circumstances around it, its planning and developments, its details and objectives, as well as its outcome and the lessons learned from the war. Also, much speculation has been made about what led to the war. When considering the situation in Lebanon, in the occupying Zionist regime, in Palestine, and in the region, as well as the U.S. role in the war, one of the main issues that needs a close look is what would have happened if the resistance in Lebanon was defeated.
Speaking of a hypothetical defeat would not be possible without examining the history of Arab defeats. Just as one cannot hypothesize about Hezbollah's defeat without taking into account the nature and identity of the supposed winner. There are two other questions that have to be asked. One is, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? And the other is, how did Hezbollah defeat Israel? Only then can one hypothesize about the consequences of a Hezbollah defeat in the 2006 war. In the first two episodes, we will take a stab at the first question, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? This episode deals with the wars between Israel and the Arabs, especially the battle that the Arabs started with a surprise attack. This is a story of two wars in the last century, one in 1948 and the other in 1973, an account unheard of from officers of the classic Arab armies. This story is based on investigations by the military research branch of the Islamic Resistance. The images take on a different personality when the founder of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, and its guardian, Ariel Sharon, join each other. These are very rare pictures of Sharon welcoming Ben-Gurion during his visit to the strongest line of fortifications in modern history, the Bar-Lev Line. It is a chain of Israeli fortifications built along the eastern coasts of the Suez Canal. The Bar-Lev Line was a massive, continuous sand wall that varied in height from 20 to 22 meters and spanned the entire 170-kilometer length of the canal. It was built 12 kilometers into the Sinai Peninsula and was inclined at an angle of 45 degrees. Then, Israel launched a massive propaganda campaign on the impenetrability of the wall and its superiority over France's World War II Maginot Line. Israel claimed the fortifications could destroy the Egyptian army in case they decided to pass the Suez Canal because the Bar-Lev Line was equipped with an underwater pipe system to pump flammable napalm into the canal and create a sheet of fire. But they were shocked when Egyptian special forces decided to pass the canal by blocking the pipe system. That was the beginning of one of the biggest military operations in modern history. In autumn 1973, every single Arab officer and soldier
was on the battlefield holding his weapon and ready to give Israel a forceful response for the 1967 defeat. Arab nations joined forces to reach their goals. Egypt and Syria launched a simultaneous attack on Israel at 2 p.m. on October 6th that fell on Israel's Yom Kippur feast. Artillery attacks targeted Israeli positions from the Syrian front, and thousands of Syrian forces backed by battalions of tanks headed to the Golan Heights. As the Syrian Air Force targeted the Israeli positions, Syrian troops advanced and inflicted a heavy loss and damage to the Israelis, losses that they weren't used to in former wars with the Arabs.
Before the attack, the enemy knew that it was going to be launched from the Syrian front, but doubtful about a strike from the Egyptian front. Therefore, they increased their forces at the Syrian borders. Israel sent its 7th Armored Battalion to the south of Bir al-Saba near the Suez Canal, and in less than 24 hours, Israeli forces were ready for battle on the Golan Heights. Syria began its offensive. The Syrian army attacked the Israeli forces, which were fully prepared. Therefore, we can say we sort of broke down their defensive line, which is one of the most difficult kinds of battle.
Nothing is more difficult than the deadlock the Israeli forces faced on the battleground at Golan Heights. The army managed to destroy many of the enemy's tanks and seize some others. They were almost as good as new, as they were only driven for a few kilometers before being deployed to the Golan Heights. It is said that the tanks were rushed there from the U.S. and the Israeli army's depots. In fact, the Israeli army dispatched its entire reserve tank battalions to the front line, its entire reserve force. It implies that an important section of the Israeli armored battalions were destroyed. It was also true for the Israeli Air Force.
In the October 1973 war, the Syrian army changed the known concepts of air defense and air battle. The country's air defense forces used the SAM-6 air defense systems creatively. Therefore, more Israeli aircraft were downed on the Syrian front than on the Egyptian.
It looks those days, at the beginning, that we were caught completely by surprise. Second, the lessons of the war of attrition, especially the capability of our air force, were not learned seriously. Our Air Force failed in the struggle between the planes against the ground-to-air system.
We knew that in order to destroy one SAM, ground-to-air batteries, we have to pay the price of one aircraft. So if we have to destroy 25 batteries, we know that we are going to lose 25 aircrafts. You know it before you start. This is a tough decision to go there. To lose an aircraft per battery. This is how high was the threat of the missiles. That we had to go there, pay the price, destroy the batteries and continue.
In air battles, Syrian pilots successfully targeted many Israeli Phantoms in short, decisive engagements.
Almost 50% of the airplanes of my squadron were shot down during the war. In order to be able to continue, you have built some walls, emotional walls. Pilots, unlike the legend, are a human being. And yes, there were pilots that stopped flying during the Yom Kippur War because of the situation. Not many, but the phenomena was new to us. those days.
The Egyptian offensive began with mortars and missiles raining on the Barlev line, a firepower equal to 175 projectiles per second.
Well, 1,500 artillery launches every minute. More than 3,000 cannons worked in the attack. Therefore, we managed to cross the Barlev line. We also prevented the enemy from employing its art fire and contingency force against us.
Egyptian infantry battalions headed toward the eastern coasts of the canal led by a special unit of BART forces. They blocked the napalm pipes. Many of them were killed as a result of the burns they suffered, but they managed to fight the Egyptian troops the opportunity to cross the Suez Canal. The action began with the Allahu Akbar, or God is Great, code, led to the passage of the Egyptian army from the water, which was a historical achievement. 12 infantry battalions were set to pass the canal and head to its eastern banks within 3 hours. But only half an hour after the first invasion, the first Egyptian flag was raised on the Barlev line and more Israeli flags were captured within a short time. After 6 hours from the beginning of the operation, 8,000 Egyptian forces crossed to the eastern banks of the canal. The engineering units managed to set up the first floating bridge that allowed mechanized to cross the waterway. Egyptian machinery and tanks were already heading to the eastern banks of the passage 18 hours in conflict. In the evening of October 7th, the number of Egyptian troops that had crossed the waterway had reached 60,000. As they made the passage, Egyptian engineers were using high-pressure water pipes to create holes in the wall of the Barlev line to destroy its foundation. Consequently, Egypt gained control over the Suez Canal's eastern banks. The first hours of the October War were the longest and most difficult for the leaders of Israel since its creation. Israel had been taken aback and couldn't believe what was happening. On the second day of the war, and in compliance with the security pact between the U.S. and Israel, the U.S. directly intervened in the conflict by opening an air route for Israel. Hundreds of planes plied Israel with its required military equipment. Daily flights carried hundreds of tons of munitions directly to the Israeli forces on the Sinai and Golan battlefields. The Soviet Union also opened its own air route for Israel on October 10th with 84 airplanes. On the end of the war, Egyptian President Anwar al-Sadat ordered Egyptian armored units to advance deep into Sinai beyond its 12-kilometer air defense cover. The decision exposed Egyptian tanks to Israeli military aircraft. Sadat took the risk despite opposition by many of the officers on the battlefield, led by Chief of Staff Saadeddin al-Shazli. Later, Sadat tried to justify his plan, saying he wanted to reduce pressure on the Syrian front.
كان بيعتمد على اساس دفع الفرقه 21 والفرقه الرابعه المدرعه من غرب القناه الى الشرق.
Sadat's decision on October 14th relied on the success of the 21st and 4th Egyptian Army divisions to cross to the east of the canal. So when we didn't make it, only 400 tanks were left for the offensive. Look at the poor planning here. We had only 400 tanks against the enemy's 900 tanks, and they had air supremacy. How is it possible that such a plan turns out successful? On that day, it was 250 out of the initial 400 tanks, and the enemy gained the upper hand. Now, did we reduce pressure on the Syrian front after such a blow to our forces and retreat into Egypt's air defense cover? No, we didn't.
These rare pictures show Israeli fighter jets heading to target Egyptian tanks out of the range of Egypt's SAM-6 anti-aircraft missile system as Israeli tanks close in Egypt's armored personnel carriers and destroy them one by one.
It was happening as Sadat was heading to Egypt's National Assembly to tell the world about the Arab army's spectacular victory against Israel.
Egypt's armed forces made a miracle come true at all military levels.
Despite Egypt's failure in the Battle of the Tanks, the Arabs had the upper hand in the war on the Sinai. Today, when Arab commanders talk of the Arab army's victory in the 1973 war, they pick an 8-day episode out of an 18-day conflict during which the Israeli army was on the defensive. But from the 10th day on, Israelis gradually began to adopt an offensive tactic. Shrewdly and efficiently, they switched their strategy. In the evening of October 15th, a small group of 7 Israeli tanks made it across the western banks of the Suez Canal to lay siege to Egypt's 3rd Army Division. The move, which later came to be known as the Split, divided the Egyptian army into 2 separate halves. The 2 parts were the Egyptian Army's 2nd Division, deployed on the northern side of the canal's eastern banks, and the 3rd Army Division on the southern side of the eastern banks, and the Split targeted the 3rd Division with a siege. An Israeli force of 330 tanks led by Sharon moved to the western banks of the canal, encircling the Egyptian army's 3rd Division, an enclosure that remained in place for 100 days, even after the end of the war. Sharon's forces also laid siege to the cities bordering the water, especially Ismailia and Suez.
All Arab armies joined forces to launch a surprise attack on Israel, but the Israeli army quickly robbed the opportunity the surprise attack had given them. The Arab forces had planned to attack the eastern banks of the Suez Canal, but it was Israel that eventually invaded the canal's western banks. The Egyptian army consisted of the 2nd and 3rd Divisions, and each division was comprised of 5 brigades. The 5 brigades of the region were fully Israeli forces, leaving the route to Cairo open to the Israelis. Also on the Syria front, the road to Damascus would have been opened if it was not for the presence of Iraqi and Jordanian forces.
Aaron's forces were there in their fullness. He had 2 armored brigades. They failed. He failed in his mission to take over Ismailia. A parachute brigade commando battalion stood up to the Israeli army. It's a great Egyptian lesson of defense.
The Egyptian and Israeli sides met at a point just 101 kilometers away from Cairo, where armored brigade managed to advance to during the war. They signed an end-conflict resolution that led withdrawal of 100,000 Egyptian and more than 1,000 of their tanks from the eastern banks of the Suez Canal to their initial pre-war positions on the canal's western banks. The resolution authorized Egypt to keep only 7,000 forces and 30 tanks on the eastern banks of the water.
I should also say that Sadat thought this is only an act of provocation, while Syria and Hafez Assad considered it a liberation war, which were 2 opposite viewpoints. From the first day of the war, Sadat and Kissinger were in contact and talked about the Egyptian army's key crossing of the Suez Canal and how to stop the war and enter negotiations. This is why Syria almost fought the war alone, except for a few days that Egypt changed its mind and decided to engage in the battle. And even that was not a serious engagement.
Despite the Syrian forces' strong resistance and sacrifices, Israel's mounting pressure on the Golan Front forced the Syrian army to return to the lands it held at the beginning of the conflict. In fact, Israel even managed to occupy more territories than it held after the 1967 war. This is a map of the lands controlled by Israel in 1967 and the extra territories they seized in 1973. It also shows Israeli forces' advancement toward Damascus and the western Suez areas they occupied on the eve of the 1973 war revolution. In spite of the Syrian army's heavy losses, the Syrian president Hafez al-Assad stood firm against U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. They held 130 hours of negotiations in the spring of 1974. Following the negotiations, Israel agreed to pull out of a vast area of land it had occupied in October 1973, to the point that Assad declared Al-Quneitra liberated.
Was liberation the main objective of the war? Or was it an act of provocation to ensure political gains? Or was the war meant to achieve a small victory to get even with Israel? This is what war meant, at least for Egypt, not for Syria. But none of these matter. I think the military aspect should be taken into consideration the moment when Arabs decided to enter the battle, be it for honorable ends or not. They decided on the time and the place where the battle was to be started and enjoyed enforcements from Morocco, Algeria, Libya, Iraq, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt and Syria. All of them participated in the 1973 offensive. If back in 1967, their governments, officials and armies could argue that they were on the defensive because they were attacked by the enemy, they had no argument of the sort in 1973. At the time, they initiated the war and were superior to Israel at a ratio of at least 10 to 1 in all spheres. But rather than gaining a clear and decisive victory to set the stage for future gains, they only settled for the imaginative victory of surprising Israel for 18 hours. Thanks to this security and military strategy, Israelis got things in their hands after the 18-hour shocker. The enemy was back, took over the battlefield, and turned Arabs' victory into a military defeat. It also humiliated Egypt's 3rd Army Division by their siege. وتم محاصرة الجيش الثالث
وبإذلال فوق العادة. The Arab government's 1973 war raised hopes, or at least the possibility, that it would open a new front against Israel. But the Arabs' failures and the outcome of the war made it the final unsuccessful move against Israel that spread a feeling of desperation among a large portion of people in the Arab world.
Let us promise each other that we shall do it earlier than between 2 and 5.
The whole experience with Menachem Begin is continuing. I can't tell until the end of it. We are just in the middle of it. Menachem is my friend, for sure. We are friends. This is a fact.
You're a man of peace, but yet you can be a man of aggression.
That's right.
Some people were shaken up by Sadat's visit, but I should only reiterate that this movement is stronger than being affected by a visit or any such thing.
In the limelight.
In March 2010, with Tea Party activists protesting loudly in the hallways of Capitol Hill and the political wind in their faces, 34 House Democrats, including Representative Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts, broke with their president to vote against passage of the Affordable Care Act. The news analysis you're about to hear has been written by Jonathan Wiseman, who is congressional correspondent and a veteran New York Times journalist. The piece is titled, Painful changes in society eased passage of bold safety net measures. March 2010, with Tea Party activists protesting loudly in the hallways of Capitol Hill and the political wind in their faces, 34 House Democrats, including Representative Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts, broke with their president to vote against passage of the Affordable Care Act. It was not enough to kill the bill, but more than enough to register deep concerns about its reach in American society and its potential impact on the midterm elections. On Friday, 19th of November 2021, Stephen Lynch and every other Democrat but one cast votes for about $2 trillion in spending on social welfare and climate change programs that arguably go much further than the health law, further, in fact, than any government intervention in half a century. And the concerns that peeled so many Democrats away from the health measure more than a decade ago were hardly in evidence, at least on their side of the aisle. "I've served a couple of times in the minority, a couple of times in the majority," said Mr. Lynch, the last remaining House Democrat who voted against Barack Obama's signature domestic achievement. "I've got a better sense of time and how these moments are rare when you can seize on something and make real change." The political and economic shifts in the United States in the decade between the first vote and the second may explain how a party still divided could unite around legislation of such sweep. The worst public health crisis in a century laid bare economic stagnation in the middle class and the soaring wealth of the super rich in America. The recovery from the coronavirus crisis is still held back by childcare costs and poor educational access that have kept parents home instead of working. Searing heat waves, record wildfires, and waves battering hurricanes have underlined the reality of climate change. And the killings of black men and women, captured on video and spread instantly around the world, raised awareness of racial injustice and inequality, just as new generation of progressives was rising up in the Democratic Party. "I've always said courage comes out of crisis," said Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat of Washington and the leader of the nearly 100-member Congressional Progressive Caucus. "You just couldn't ignore this stuff anymore. It was intolerable to watch." Those forces appeared to unite Democrats as they made their way to the Capitol to vote. There were no shouts from angry opponents like the ones that greeted Democrats in 2010 as they prepared to approve the Affordable Care Act. The main barrier to passage was an 8-hour speech by the House Republican leader, Representative Kevin McCarthy of California. Beyond the chamber, the only activists in evidence were a small clutch of supporters singing old union songs and someone dressed like the Build Back Better Act, modelled after the bill in the old Schoolhouse Rock video. The social safety net and climate bill still must navigate a tortuous road through the evenly divided Senate, where a single defection would bring it down. If it is able to clear that chamber, it most likely will have to go back to the House for a final vote, devoid of some of its items that drew Democrats to support it on Friday. But if it is enacted, it will touch virtually every American life, from birth to death, akin to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal or Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society. Its generous subsidies for childcare and universal pre-kindergarten are are designed to lift the struggling working class into a less precarious economic position. Ample housing support, more higher education aid and worker training programs in the bill would reach well into the middle class. Home and community health care, a new hearing benefit for Medicare, and price controls for prescription drugs would ease the lives of older Americans. All of that could reasonably be described as big government excess, and Republicans have made that case repeatedly for months. The scope and cost of the bill, if anything, is understated by its roughly $2 trillion price tag, because Democrats kept the cost down by phasing in some measures and arbitrarily ending others well before the expiration of the bill's 10-year window, some after a single year. In all, according to the Committee for a Reasonable Budget, if the entire Build Back Better Act were made permanent, the 10-year cost would be $4.9 trillion, which would exceed the inflation-adjusted 4-year cost of the Second World War, as Kevin McCarthy charged repeatedly over 8 hours. Yet a combined assault by business organizations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, their political operatives at groups like American Action Network, and the intense focus on the Republican Party against what they call socialist early education, crippling tax increases and dangerous limitations on drug companies was not enough to peel away even 4 House Democrats, the bare minimum that would have been needed to defeat